Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. We are going to get further into this dialogue regarding the foundation of the framers. We kind of covered some summations and more information yesterday. We're going to actually get into some of the details regarding the Constitution, the Convention, and so forth. But before we do, let me just take care of the things I usually try to sneak in. This show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And you are listening to the only show that provides you the academic-based evidence and the academic-based solutions. And so we've not caught up. We got a few shows that since Tuesday that we haven't put up. It's a one-man show here, if you couldn't tell. That's why I keep firing my IT guy, but I end up bringing him back again. So, anyways, as my wife and mother always told me, only you think you're funny. Anywho, one of the things I've kind of said and I want to repeat, because I think this really gets right down to the message here. If you look at what's going on, and if you look at the reality, if it becomes a reality that the globalists or the evil side actually takes over, and Trump doesn't get another 4 years to kind of appease the conservatives, then what we have to understand is if we are going to fight this evil enemy, whether that be Satan, the globalists, whatever you deem as the enemy, if we have to fight them, we cannot fight them on their own terms and on their own ground. If we do, we will lose, because their terms, their where they choose to fight, like in the courts and so forth, they've got those things stacked against us. And they've done this all unconstitutionally. So the only way we are going to succeed is by getting the states to actually convene their own court, as Madison asserted in 1800, that only the states are the judges and the jury. Regardless of whether you think the states are legitimate or not, regardless of what you think of the election, regardless of how things are, when we vote for, we, the people, the sovereign people, delegate within this constitutional framework that the Lord gave us, not what the Satan has kind of created in his, in his studio of mirrors and smoke and magic. When we get our state legislators to actually do their job and to take a stand and say, where did we allow you to do all of these things, to even change the ground we're standing on? It is all an illusion. And in so doing, we will actually dismantle, blow down their house of cards and dismantle their weaponry, their bureaucratic weaponry that they've created to enslave us. Folks, if you believe that the framers were blessed by the divine hand of providence at the time when they needed it the most, from the Revolutionary War to the point where the Lord inspired this Constitution, if you believe that he would bless them then, why would he withhold his blessings now? All we have to do is move forward with faith and not give up. I feel sometimes like I'm Madison trying to pursue the Constitutional Convention. And to be clear, that's what Madison was trying to pursue. But what I'm trying to pursue is the enforcement of the Constitution. And I believe with faith and faith with others, we'll actually be able to do this. So anyway, now we can kind of jump into some of the stuff that we've kind of left off. And one of the things we left off, oh, by the way, if you haven't noticed, I've been coughing a little bit lately. So I've contracted, because I got a cold when I traveled down to Phoenix for the Constitution Party Central Committee meeting, National Convention, whatever you want to call it. And for the most part, when I came back from going from 100 degree weather to freezing and snow, I caught a travel cold, you know, and I've had them before. But I, because it was so cold and I had to get out and my immune system and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, long story short, my coughing is kind of because I've got this walking pneumonia. So hopefully we'll get that all cleared up in the next couple of weeks. I mean, I usually do have a frog, but I, if you haven't noticed, I've been coughing a little bit or clearing my throat a little bit more lately. But anywho, the Constitutional Convention. So let me kind of set the stage. Shays Rebellion occurred, and all sorts of realities were popping into everybody's head that the states weren't going to make good on their debt to the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation, or I should say, the Continental Congress and this new Confederacy, this general government set up to support the Confederacy, was basically going to default on its loans with Holland, France, and a lot of the countries that helped subsidize our war. And so we were looking at literally capitulating. And if we capitulated, then the outcome would have been that Britain would have taken over again. They would have come right in, because we wouldn't have had anything to stop them, because there's no country that's going to continually invest in nations, because we were independent sovereigns at that time with a confederacy. And nobody is going to support this republic of nations that isn't going to actually honor their debt. So the failings up in New England with the Shays Rebellion, and everybody was really looking at, oh man, this is it. We are going to fail. And it was like a slow train wreck in the process of happening, just like what we're seeing now, friends. What we see now is a very slow process, and at any point in time during this process, we can change the outcome and events by calling for and getting Republic Review moving. We can actually do this. We still have the time, believe it or not. And I will say this. I challenge you to challenge the Lord in proving this miracle, in proving that he won't bless us, because I know he will. So anyway, the real holdup, just like the Revolutionary War, the real holdup in getting this Constitutional Convention, which was approved and ordained in Annapolis. They had a convention of the states, and the states' delegates kind of met in Annapolis, and they kind of agreed that they needed to have this rework of the Articles of Confederation to fix some of the problems so that they can stay solvent, to pay their debts and so forth. Well, there was no way that they were going to be able to do that in keeping the Articles of Confederation the way they were. There needed to be some real changes, but for the most part, there, if you really look at them, they were just minor changes. As I call our Constitution and our Republic a hybrid Constitution Republic, what we have today is both a Confederacy and a Federation. The Federation has delegated powers to declare war, to manage the importing and exporting of commerce between the states and the nations, because you realize Washington, D.C. doesn't export anything other than, you know, ill-advised, you know, policies and so forth. They are not producers. They're just basically setting up supposedly advantages for the states and taking the states' interest. But one has to ask why. How are they, you know, taking the state's interest in mind when you look at the energy policies and some of these other things that we've done? The Obama administration was antithetical to what was in the Republic's best interest. And as a matter of fact, one of the things I'd love to see is I would love to see the attorney generals of each state and or the state legislators themselves, when they feel like the president and the administration is overstepping its bounds, I would love to see the states call for an impeachment. That's what should have happened with Obama. The states should have called for an impeachment when he tried to ramrod this unconstitutional thing called Obamacare. The states need to be far more proactive. And this is why, if you really look at the process as we see the process of Republic Review, anybody that is concerned about the Convention of States, if Republic Review goes forward and it unfolds the power of the states in controlling the behavior of the federal government, the question is, why do we need a convention for the states in Article 5 anymore? The only reason that we really put that in there was for the states as a last resort to enforce the compact. Because the federal government becomes so defunct that they needed to actually create a new constitution. We don't need to create a new constitution anymore. Once we've realized that we've been given the power necessary in the constitution itself. The problem was that during Madison and Hamilton's time, they couldn't even fathom what they had. They didn't realize this is why they maintained the Convention of States within the Constitution. So anyway, we're back to the real kingpin of making the Constitutional Convention even happen was George Washington. So when Madison finally got George Washington to commit to becoming a delegate to the Convention of States, then everybody, okay, this is legitimate. We're going to go. We're going to make this happen. And so what we had was, and actually there's a lot more to this backstory. Madison worked and worked and worked, and he actually communicated with General Knox. I believe he was the, what was he? Let me up here. So General Knox, if I remember correctly, he was in charge of the artillery and, you know, during the Revolutionary War. And he was a big contributor to the very beginning of the Revolutionary War. And it was he that, through a letter, convinced Washington not to worry about the Society of Cincinnati and what else is going on. But we will be right back after these two promos.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and Republic Review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, so anyway, so General Knox, who worked with George Washington, and as a matter of fact, I think he was involved in the Society of Cincinnati, which, if you really look at the Society of Cincinnati, it was kind of like an early age in this new world, an early age of aristocracy, those who had wealth and those who were prominent in society. And so George Washington was really heavily considering joining this. And as a matter of fact, If you didn't know, he was probably one of the richest men in the nation. He was a huge land speculator, and as a matter of fact, he bought a lot of land out in the Ohio Valley from the Indian Wars and so forth, because he was pretty familiar with, you know, because he was out there fighting wars. And so he kind of knew which land would be good to have and which wouldn't be. And so, long story short, Madison sent a few letters to Knox, and Knox sent a couple of letters to Washington to convince Washington to forego his interest at this point in time, that the nation needed him to help with this constitutional convention that was coming up in Philadelphia in May of 1787. And so what ended up happening was that actually persuaded Washington to change his focus and to, you know, concede and accept to go as a delegate for the state of Virginia. Now, prior to the Constitutional Convention, the delegates in Virginia met, and it's the same thing probably what happened in all of the other states. Now, most people thought it was a runaway convention, but it really was not a runaway convention as it is, quote-unquote, described by some constitutional scholars that tend to work for a organization that is steeped in this concept of the status quo. And so, and this is why I would venture to tell anybody to read Federalist Papers, start with 39 and go to 40 to 50. Just read those 11 Federalist Papers. You'll notice, in, I believe it's Federalist Paper 40 or 41, where Madison actually takes umbrage. He takes exception with the fact that the anti-federalists were accusing him of not following the guidance and counsel of the Annapolis Convention, that they were supposed to fix the Articles of Confederation. And he actually points out how they actually did that. I mean, he took insult. And as a matter of fact, anybody today that has read the Federalist Papers that understand how he was taking insult and defending what they did, they're just repeating the same insult by saying it was a runaway convention. They went and they did their job. What they didn't want is they didn't want to have any outside influences, which is one of the reasons why they were sworn to secrecy. So, long story short, George Washington conceded, the convention was on, and I believe it was something like May 25th, 26th, something like that. They actually convened and they got started. And Washington was there. Benjamin Franklin was there. I mean, the who's who of American politics was there. And as you know, they had all of these problems just trying to come to an agreement. And so, as I was saying, Virginia actually met before the convention. And they went through Madison's plan. And actually, Madison's plan was adopted as the Virginia plan. And Governor Randolph was the one that was responsible because he was the chief delegate. And so he basically presented the Virginia plan as soon as the convention kicked off. And after they had decided how to break up, you know, the convention, who was going to be the president and so forth. Once they took care of all of the formalities, they got started. And Governor Randolph briefed this Virginia convention. And it was rejected. And so the New Jersey plan came forth. And the New Jersey plan was one that actually was very similar to the Articles of Confederation, that the states would be equal. But the Virginia plan was apportionment based on the people, that there would be a House of Representatives based on the people, that there would be this inequality, the states that had the highest population. And at that point in time, if I remember correctly, North Carolina, Virginia, Massachusetts, I mean, if you look at, you know, who had the most influence population-wise, well, the smaller states, I mean, I think Delaware was like 80,000, and shoot, Virginia was over 500,000. And so they were really concerned. And So when the Virginia plan basically was presented and they started arguing the merits of, you know, representation of the people, Delaware basically came right on. I forget exactly who said this, because I'm bad with names, but there was a gentleman that says, we don't trust you big states. You're going to try to force us and marginalize us, and we're basically going along for a ride, and we're not going along for the ride. And if that's the case, and if you want to make appropriation or the power rested by the people, then we're done. We're out of here. So it looked like the Constitution was going to fail. And I believe it was about this point in time when Benjamin Franklin said, hey, you know, if a dove or a sparrow can fall from the heavens and the Lord notices, surely we're you know, fooling ourselves if we believe we can create a nation without the Lord's assistance. And so he called for the prayer beginning each day of the sessions. And so they all convened. They went down the street, and I guess there was a church, and they all went in there and started praying, and the spirit had then changed. And it moved from contention to actually compromise. And it was Roger Sherman that came up with this concept of American republicanism. And I've said this before, but I can't stress this enough. So I want you to really get this and pay attention. The compromise and the reality of republicanism in America shifted because of the Constitutional Convention. Because Sherman basically argued that even though the people are the sovereigns, when we create government, we actually delegate to them sovereignty for us over very specific matters, such as the fighting of war and, you know, how to manage foreign trade, both incoming and outgoing. And so in so doing this, he basically set a brand new paradigm that actually recognized dual sovereignty. And in so doing, they actually created the framework of the federal government, having two houses of Congress. One house that would have the responsibilities that would be more suited for the people, like declaring war and laying taxes and those types of things that would be of the people's interest. And the other house would be more of the, you know, the bureaucratic side and the political side of and those people who would understand better, you know, who would make good judges, who would make good ambassadors and those types of things. So the Senate was given the responsibilities of the administrative levels as well as looking at treaties, because the people may not even understand the consequences and the details of those types of matters. So the responsibilities were literally divided between the House of Representatives and the Senate. And this was brilliant. This laid out this new concept of sovereignty, that sovereignty wasn't just, and as a matter of fact, during the ratification debates, the use and term of sovereign was constantly being thrown at the state legislators. As a matter of fact, at that point in time, prior to the Revolutionary War, the sovereign was the king, King George. And Parliament had some, you know, some responsibilities between the House of Lords and the House of Commons, but the ultimate sovereign was the king. Now, that's what Hamilton wanted. And there were a lot of other Anglicans, or I should say Anglophiles, that's what they were called, people that, you know, had an affinity for the British government, the British system. And so these men really wanted to have a life term, term or duration of service. When a president was appointed, they was appointed until death. They wanted to institute a monarch system, but a monarch system where the people selected that. And, you know, they go, well, hold on, you know, what if the people grow tired because he becomes despotic or what have you? And there was the arguments back and forth of impeachments and so forth. Long story short, what ended up happening is they created a government that didn't please Hamilton, and it was antithetical to what Madison wanted. And to show you the character of these two separate men, Hamilton went off and figured out ways he could try to undermine the existing system to push it in the direction that he thought was best. Kind of sounds like a communist, doesn't it? Where Madison basically looked at this new system that was being adopted and said, well, this is the system we're giving, and this is what we're going to live by and enforce. And so when you really look at the arguments after the Constitutional Convention between Hamilton and Madison, Madison was the one that was always staying true to the terms and definitions of both the things that they talked about during the Constitutional Convention, as well as the way they described each of these things during the ratification debates. And he was very consistent in supporting the defined Constitution from those ratification debates as well as the Constitutional Convention. And he constantly lectured people regarding compliance to those definitions and terms. So we'll be right back after these two breaks. Thank you so much.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
So to be clear, so one of the things that we've kind of come to realize is that they created a new structure for sovereignty in Virginia, as well as Massachusetts, as well as, I think it was North Carolina, where they pointed out that, hey, you know, there are two separate sovereigns here in this government. There's, this House of Representatives, and there's this Senate. And this bicameral legislative body, even though it was quasi-modeled after Parliament, it wasn't. Parliament represented two classes of people, the common folk and the lords, or I should say the aristocracy. And it was the same thing in Rome as well as almost all constitutional governments, where they recognized the people of varying degrees. There was never, and I emphasize this, there was never a recognition of sovereignty of governments subordinate to the system. In other words, when we look at who the sovereigns are in the federal government, we have the people as apportioned by state, do not think that, you know, your representation crosses state boundaries. This is why every state was guaranteed a minimum of one representative. If you look at Wyoming, if you look at the Dakotas, if you look at Montana possibly, there's several states where there's only one representative. Now, one of the things that I kind of want to emphasize is this was so incredibly ingenious that after the Constitution was ratified, every state reorganized their legislative bodies to be bicameral in kind. So here's the question. When you look at your state government and you go, why do we have a Senate and a House of Representatives if they really only represent the people? The intent, when they remodeled the state governments, the Senate represented the counties, the sub-element of government, just like the states were the sub-element of government. And oh, by the way, the representation of the people was by county as well. Why is this? Why was this done this way? Because the framework was recognized. The framework by the framers was recognized as a as an interest. So when you look at the sub-elements of government in the United States, you can definitely see that the interest of the heartland is a lot different than the interest of the coastlines. Well, that's the same thing in a state. If you have a coastline county and you have a mountainous county and a desert region county, and you have each county has unique disparate interests of commerce, you know, as well as the people, as well as, you know, utilities, water, all of these types of things are different across the board. And so the counties actually had a guaranteed representative, and then the additional representatives went to the more populated counties. But for the most part, they basically broke down the state government and state legislative bodies identical to how they did the United States government. Every state went into a bicameral legislative body. As a matter of fact, something you didn't know, that Nebraska, which is now unicameral, was a bicameral legislative body until the 1930s, when all of a sudden they kind of realized that, hey, you know, who's represented in the Senate now? It's the people. It's no longer the states. And because of that, they sent a political message to state, well, if we're not having to, you know, have a separate representation for the sub-element of government, to the counties and or the federal government, the states, then we're just going to boil down to, you know, being a representation of the people, and we're not going to basically, you know, seem hypocritical that we have to have these disparate powers of a Senate and a House. We're just going to put all the, because that's what we're doing anyway. All the counties are being represented by the people, not by the sub-element of government. And as a matter of fact, legislative districts in every state today have morphed across county lines to where in California, I believe there's 10 counties that have to share their representatives in, you know, some of these far out distant type of counties. I just want you to understand, my friends, that we've perverted ourselves, and the cause of this was the stupid court system and the ruling in Sims v. Reynolds. Or Reynolds v. Sims. I think it was Reynolds v. Sims. Anyway, fact of the matter is, as they were moving forward, this brilliance of these two sovereigns, you know, really took a foothold, and then it got marginalized, it got perverted and subverted by the concept of democracy, that the people needed representation. Well, the people had representation. And as a matter of fact, there was a better representation, because going back to my point on counties and states, your interest in your counties along the coastline and the interest of those in the agricultural belt and those in the mountains and the forestry belts and so forth, the interests are different, And so they needed to have a minimum representation to ensure that their interests were coming to the table. Now, when you have to share representation of 10 counties, how is each county being represented? No wonder they feel like they're just a number. No wonder they're being walked over by the population centers who are getting all of the advantages. When this system was described by Madison, it was described as a protector of the minorities. And when I say minorities, I don't mean demographics of race, culture, sex, or anything like that. The minorities that they were talking about were bodies and governments of the people. In other words, the counties. They wanted to make sure that the less populated counties had some level of representation and protection. Today, we see throughout the United States, we actually see population centers controlling the majority of every state. You can see this in probably Arizona. You definitely see this in Nevada. You definitely see this in California. You definitely see this in Oregon and Washington. You probably can see it in Idaho. You definitely see this in Utah, Indiana, Illinois. As we move across all of these states, we find these huge cities that are destroying the states. This is why I believe that one of the things that we need to do, not now, but after we have Republic Review and after we start, you know, getting the states back on track, is dividing every single one of these states so that these population centers can become their own self-source destruction. In other words, if they want to create policies of liberal, you know, handouts and everything else, then they can be the one that, you know, basically have to lie in their bed. They made it, they can lie in it. But there will be no bailouts. As a matter of fact, when a state fails, they don't get a handout from the federal government. What happens, just like in any other contract or any other corporation, and I don't want to, you know, create a buzzword for anybody that's out there going, he's talking about corporations. States are corporations. What I mean, when a state or an entity goes defunct, you send it into conservatorship, and basically you get accountants to come in and say, hey, you don't have the money to hand out to people. You got to have to stop all of this. You have to basically, you know, reduce your government, reduce your administrative costs and all of this, and get the state back into functioning terms again. This is how you force those things. Because as long as the states can continually subsidize socialism, and how are they doing this? Well, in California, they used to be able to write off their socialist taxes against their federal taxes. And so the federal government has been basically subsidizing socialism throughout the United States when they were allowing these subsidies, or I should say not these subsidies, but these write-offs against your state taxes. So the more usury the state taxes were becoming, well, that's okay. It was offset by your federal taxes for the most part. Well, not anymore. And that's because of Trump. So the one thing I can say that yay for Trump is he ended this so that states could actually realize and actualize, you know, what they were doing to their people, and the people could wake up and go, are you kidding me? You know, why are we spending all this money for, you know, handouts for these sanctuary cities? All these things that are illegal and unconstitutional. Anyway, so American republicanism was something that truly grew, and it's something that spawned out of the Constitutional Convention on this concept of sovereignty. And so as they basically pounded out this Constitution, some of the things inside the Constitution, and we kind of went through these when we read the Constitution back in September, but some of the things that were called out and identified in the ratification debates that were very, very problematic were the what we call the mystical clauses, the General Defense and Welfare Clause, the Commerce Clause, the Necessary and Proper Clause, and the Supremacy Clause. And so when we come back after these two breaks, we will go into these clauses and what the intent of each of these clauses were. And in so doing, it will help you understand that these clauses were not portals to granting new powers. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me, AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so hey, the good news is I haven't had a real coughing spell. I've been able to suppress it till the breaks. So anyway, when they pounded out this Constitution, they created some clauses that provided what most people would have considered innocuous, to all of a sudden becoming these fulcrums where the federal government could start waging political warfare against the states using these clauses. So the first clause, the General Defense and Welfare Clause, that is in the preamble of Article 1, Section 8, and it's obviously subsection 1. Or if you read the Constitution and you go to Article 1, Section 8, then we actually go through exactly what this says. Because what this does, and as a matter of fact, the way this whole thing was explained in the ratification debates, is what would be the purpose to create subsection 1 or the preamble and then list the powers if the intent was to grant the federal government general powers, which it wasn't. And in other words, so this is what basically is the preamble to the enumeration of powers: to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. So to be clear, this right here basically stated that, okay, so we're going to give the federal government powers, and this is the umbrella of the powers that we're kind of going to do. Well, so then they started listing to borrow money on the credit for the United States, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. Now, I'm going to stop right there because there's the Commerce Clause. But the General Welfare and Defense Clause was just an overall preamble. It was not a delegation of general powers. because throughout the ratification debates, it was very well stipulated and defined that the enumerated powers after this, that was just the preamble, that it would be pointless if they granted general powers to create a list of powers being granted. That those were, in a general sense, not giving the government general powers, but basically laying out the intent. Because the intent was to provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, not a granting of general powers. Now, moving on to the Commerce Clause, to regulate commerce with foreign nations. Well, do we go and dictate to foreign nations what they can produce? No. So the same would be applied to states, that the federal government can't dictate to the states what products they're going to provide. The only regulation that they have goes back up to laying taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, not to manage and control the production of the world, because in the Commerce Clause, it includes the regulating of foreign nations, the several states, and with Indian tribes. In other words, they were recognizing that there were three origins of commerce: the states, foreign nations, and as well as the Indian tribes, because the Indian tribes were still at this point autonomous in some essences. They weren't, as a matter of fact, they weren't creating reservations. They were actually allowing them to have their own kind of communities, but they weren't creating federal land. And as a matter of fact, no federal land existed for any of the tribes that were granted areas of land. And so, to be very, very clear, my friends, the regulation of commerce was strictly for taxation as well as ensuring the protecting of the interests. So if America started creating really high-tech stuff, that we didn't want that intellectual property to be stolen from China, then we would create regulations to protect that so it couldn't go to China. But if you look at how the federal government has been regulating commerce, it hasn't been to the benefit of the republic. It has been to the demise of the republic. And it's, you know, another thing I'll say about Trump is Trump has been actually calling out China for its intellectual property thievery and the way it has been trying to, you know, commit economic warfare against the United States by stealing our intellectual property. We should have stopped at the very beginning when they did their first re-engineering of American products. We should have stopped all production and said, you can no longer produce in China. No products in China will be allowed, and no American company will be allowed or protected if doing business in China. And so there we go. As we, you know, move forward, that kind of, I don't want to say kills, but that helps explain both the General Defense and Welfare Clause, as well as it helps explain the Commerce Clause. So the next clause is the Necessary and Proper. And as a matter of fact, I'm going through these as they appear in the Constitution. So these first three, the General Defense and Welfare, is the preamble to Section 8. Then the Commerce Clause is like Subsection 3. And then the Necessary and Proper Clause, well, this baby is Subsection 17. And so, 18, I'm sorry. And it states this: to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into the execution the foregoing powers. There's no comma in what I just read. The comma is after powers. And so people say, well, they've got this power to do all of these things. And oh, by the way, I will touch on this exclusive legislation up in 17, to exercise exclusive legislation. And if you've listened to me talk about this as we go through the ratification debates, as well as the Constitution, when we read this, we go through this over and over and over again. And I'm hoping that hearing it in these different contexts, it actually helps make sense to you. So regarding the necessary and proper, the best way this was described was by Mr. Nicholas during the ratification debates when he said, had we just listed at the end of each power that we were delegating that Congress shall have the, you know, Congress shall be able to make laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing power. And so had they done that at the end of each line, to regulate commerce and to make laws which shall be necessary and proper for the carrying into execution of foregoing power, to establish a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws and subject to bankruptcies throughout the United States, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. Yeah, so basically he said, had we added this to the end, it would have been very redundant and just excessive. So what they did was they just put it at the end, but they still included into execution the foregoing powers. Well, so that is including all of the powers that were just enumerated in the list above. And so, as you can see, you know, they really clarified each of these, and they actually spelled it out, as far as I'm concerned, to the detail of how these three clauses had no possibility, nada, in granting the federal government any new power. So the last clause in question was the Supremacy Clause, and it basically is in Article 6, Section 2. The Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof. In other words, it shall be made in congruence, in harmony, and based upon the powers delegated in the Constitution. All laws made by the United States based on those enumerated powers and or of the treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. And there is the Supremacy Clause. Now, to be very, very clear, even treaties were bound by the enumerated powers. And these aren't just idle words I'm saying. And let me look at how much time. I got 1 minute. So I'm not going to be able to, you know, pull out the citation, but I do want to read this. So we're going to get into the citation in the next episode, precisely where these limitations on treaties were galvanized, or I should say where they coagulated, where they formed and took substance. It was George Nicholas that clarified that if the federal government only has jurisdiction on these things, they can't go off and make a treaty about something such as religion, such as speech, entertainment, broadcasting, energy. If it's something that is not an enumerated power, they have no business, they have no authority to exercise any power to create a treaty with a foreign entity. This is where the states and the Senate should actually say, hey, hold it. You don't have this authority to be able to create these kinds of regulations of energy, of broadcasting, of transportation, you know, such as aviation. And I know everybody's shaking their head going, well, those things are so important. Well, they're still states' powers. And the states are still the ones that need to do this. So, just to be very, very clear, my friends, as they went through these clauses, as they spelled every single one of these out during the ratification debates, they set the terms and definitions for this very thing. And with that, we're going to get into more of this in the next episode. We're building the case for you to understand we have to call for Republic Review. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.